From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Ebola outbreak is spreading rapidly across West Africa. Over 1,000 people have died and more than 2,000 have been infected. Criticism is mounting that not enough is being done, and there are big ethical concerns over the use of experimental drugs and who does not get them. This hour on Point, the race to stop Ebola. You can join us on air or online. What's your question about the Ebola outbreak? What are your concerns? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me today from New York is Dr. Ian Lipkin. He is expert in viral diseases and director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University. He has over 30 years of experience with outbreak response, including AIDS, West Nile virus, and SARS. Dr. Ian Lipkin, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thanks, Jane.
So the World Health Organization has issued increasingly frantic warnings over the last few days, saying that the number of people sickened or killed by Ebola may, quote, vastly underestimate the magnitude of this outbreak. How would you describe the severity of this Ebola outbreak?
It is the most severe Ebola outbreak in history. We don't know what the final tally will be. It's almost certainly going to be much larger than it is now. And the concern, however, is really restricted at present to West Africa, where we have a humanitarian crisis. It's not something that we think of as being likely to become a pandemic threat.
Without getting too graphic here, what does Ebola do to the body? Why is it so deadly?
Well, this is, although it's really not, there are two factors we consider in thinking about infectious agents. One is the transmissibility, how rapidly or easily does it go from one person to the next or one animal to a person and so on. And the other, of course, is the type of disease that it results in. And Ebola is one of the most lethal of infections known. We see in some outbreaks up to 90% of people dying. The numbers here look like they're more like 50 to 60%, but that's still an enormous burden. And people die of multi-system failure. You know, you have all of these organs in your body that have to detoxify your blood. They have to oxygenate your blood. They have to pump the blood to where it needs to go. And in essence, what happens is because you're unable to maintain an adequate blood pressure and blood flow, your kidneys shut down, your liver shuts down. The graphic pictures that people see where they talk about individuals bleeding from every orifice or quote-unquote melting is really not as frequent as the multi-system shutdown that I've just described.
Let's go to West Africa for a moment here. Joining me now from Accra, Ghana is Drew Hinshaw. He's a contributing reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He just left Liberia where he was covering the Ebola outbreak for more than a month. He's also been on the ground in Nigeria. Drew Hinshaw, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you. What have you been seeing on the ground in Liberia and in Nigeria, Drew?
Oh, it's bad. Nigeria is actually well contained. The government's done a good job containing it. But in Liberia, it looks almost certain that the numbers provided by the World Health Organization, saying that about 1,000 have died and 2,000 have gotten sick, are woefully underestimated. And the WHO has said that itself. Just to give you an example, I just stumbled into one kind of village area in a rubber plantation, and health workers there who are on strike because they don't have the basic equipment like gloves to treat Ebola told me that 30 people just in that little village area alone had died in the past week. Those are people who haven't been counted. They haven't walked into the hospital. No one knows about them. And that's just one little village I stumbled into. There's many, many, many more.
I'm reading reports here that say that the outbreak is so out of control, as you suggest here, that governments are literally drawing lines around infected areas where no one is allowed out, that patients are filling treatment centers faster than beds can be found. How are these infected patients being treated, Drew?
Right. Well, what the Liberian government has done is, and Sierra Leone has been similar, is they're setting up transit centers. All the schools in the country are closed because of Ebola, so they're going into schools and making them into what they call transit centers. That's it. The second you catch a fever, it's supposed to work, is you go there, you lie on a bed, they take your blood sample, and they find out if you have malaria, the flu, or something else, or you have Ebola. And if you don't have Ebola, you're free to go. If you do have Ebola, then they treat you early, you have to survive and go up considerably. The problem is, I don't know, people are panicked, you know? No one wants to go into these transit centers. Mm-hmm. Ebola is. a scary disease. They don't want to catch it while they're there. Everyone thinks they don't have Ebola. Everyone thinks they've got malaria or some, you know, more quotidian ailment. So just the weekend, people in Liberia ransacked a transit center. They went in there and stole their place's mattresses and took their loved ones out of there. So what they're trying to do has been really set back by a kind of panic that's underway in Liberia.
So is Ebola in cities yet, or is it still mostly in these small communities and villages? Has it spread to the bigger communities?
Yeah. It is definitely in cities, and that is the scariest part on this ailment, this current epidemic. You know, the West Point area of Monrovia, the very densely packed area, which is where this treatment center transit center that was looted over the weekend is. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a place that's dense. And it's definitely spreading that. And we saw a list that the kind of community had kind of put together on their own. It was long. And again, these are names that are not known to the WHO. It's a disease that spreads within families. And you're talking about a part of the world where families, you know, cohabitate quite a bit. You'll have, mm-hmm. you know, two or three nuclear families squeezed into a single house. And you can imagine the scenario. You're a mother and your kid gets sick, or your aunt and niece gets sick. And you know, of course, you're going to help them. You're going to clean them up, take care of them. And then you get it, and your husband, you know, takes care of you and gets it. And on it goes, and it will continue to spread until people can break that kind of caregiving. Mm.
From your reporting, Drew, from what you've seen, are there enough medical personnel in these countries to deal with the size of this seemingly growing epidemic?
Right. Yes, 10,000% no. Not just for Ebola, because the Liberian and Sierra Leone health systems have shut down. Doctors have walked off the ship because they don't have the supplies of treating Ebola. A lot of aid groups told me that more people are probably dying from malaria, typhoid, dysentery, the sort of endemic diseases that are always in Liberia, than Ebola. So, I mean, just to put that another way, Ebola has, in a way, a double death toll. There's people who are actually dying from Ebola, and there is probably a greater number of people who are dying from treatable illnesses because they refuse to go into a hospital because they're afraid to get Ebola, mm-hmm. or because the hospital is closed because the doctors are afraid to get getting Ebola. So absolutely. This is a medical disaster in many, many ways.
So Kenya has just closed its borders to travelers coming from and going through the West African countries hit by Ebola. That would be Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea, Nigeria. As you've mentioned, flights have been suspended. Kenyan Airlines. I mean, there must be active concern, as you're suggesting here, about the spread beyond West Africa.
Well, that's the tricky part. It is possible for the disease to travel by plane, but it's a little bit unlikely. And as we've seen in Nigeria, having a passenger on a plane and land and then show symptoms of Ebola is in many ways the ideal way for Ebola to spread into a country, because then you've got a passenger manifest. You can see clearly who was interacting with him. You know who was working, who was cleaning that plane that day. And what we've seen in Nigeria is exactly that. Someone got in the plane, went to Lagos, got off the plane, had Ebola, and the Nigerian government has done a remarkable job tracking everyone who interacted with that individual, the people who cleaned the plane, the nurses who treated him. Mm-hmm. And they've, in a country of 170 million, only 12 Nigerians have been confirmed infected. I mean, that's a remarkable accomplishment. And the World Health Organization has really discouraged countries from canceling flights. In many ways, it doesn't help. Aid workers are saying these cancellations of flights are actually limiting the pace at which they can bring supplies into Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. So while it's possible for this to spread by air, it's quite unlikely. Mm. And in many ways, these flight cancellations are setting the fight back, not forward. Mm.
Drew Hinshaw, contributing reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Drew, thank you for your excellent work. We appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, too, Jen.
Let's go back to Dr. Ian Lipkin, Director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University. Doctor, thanks for starting us off here. You told us what Ebola does to the body. You just heard what Drew Hinshaw, his reports on the ground. Speak from a medical perspective and tell us how someone is infected with Ebola. How is it transmitted, Doctor?
Well, the point I think that Drew was just making about transmission, you know, that has really been you know, has really been arrested in Nigeria because people took the right precautions is right on point. This is not an infection that is spread easily. One has to come into contact with a dead body, the secretions associated with a dead body like blood or semen or saliva, sitting next to someone on a plane who is not vomiting or bleeding, and coming into contact with that is not going to result in transmission or risk to you. So the reason this has taken off the way it has in West Africa is there are cultural practices which are, you know, really, you know, these go back, you know, hundreds of years, where you take care of individuals who are ill yourself. This is what the family does. And particularly when you have hospitals where there's inadequate personnel to take care of patients, it makes sense for family members to do this. And then the preparation of bodies for burial, touching these bodies as a way of, you know, sending them off, is another risk factor, a huge risk factor, which is not common in many other parts of the world. So it was a perfect storm. Now, had we been more proactive when we saw the first signs of this emerging in West Africa, we might have contained it more easily than we can do right now. The problem now is that you have all these little epicenters all over West Africa, right? And each one of them is a potential site from which that infection can spread. That said, with adequate personal protective equipment, with adequate training, with staffing, we can bring this outbreak under control. The problem is that we don't have that sort of support.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're discussing the Ebola outbreak in West Africa this hour. The World Health Organization says that more than 1,000 people have died and more than 2,000 have been infected, and it is still not contained. Last Friday in Geneva, Switzerland, Dr. Isabelle Natal, director of the World Health Organization's Global Capacity Alert and Response Division, discussed travel to West African countries with active Ebola cases.
WHO is not recommending any travel restriction. When decisions are made by airline companies, they have to take into consideration their perceived risk and the real economic impact on countries that are already affected by a disease that they have to control.
And here is a health administrator in Liberia standing in front of his hospital with a photo of one of the five healthcare workers who died of Ebola at his clinic. One doctor survived.
Ebola crisis infected 6 of our health workers, including this photo that is here. You know, 5 of them died, except a doctor that was first pronounced positive, and later after going through the treatment, he was later pronounced negative.
We have an expert panel this hour. We're talking with Dr. Ian Lipkin. He's an expert in viral diseases and director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University. He has over 30 years of experience responding to outbreaks, including AIDS, West Nile virus, and SARS. And joining me now from Washington is Dr. Jesse Goodman. He is director of Georgetown University's Compass Center, a health policy research center. Until February of this year, he was chief scientist at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, focused on protecting the public from health threats. He led the FDA's response to the 2009 H1N1 pandemic. Dr. Goodman, welcome to you. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Hi, Jane. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, thank you for taking the time. We just heard from the Liberian minister there at the hospital in Liberia. Talk to us about how aid workers are protecting themselves. Do they have the supplies? Do they have the resources to properly do so?
Well, I've been reading, you know, I haven't been on the ground there, but I've been reading very disturbing reports and also hearing from colleagues that they lack even the basic supplies necessary to protect themselves. And I think this points out a dichotomy where here in the West, we're talking about fancy, high-tech, expensive, new experimental therapies, when we have steps we could take immediately to reduce risk to healthcare workers and enable them to do the public health and infection control that's really needed. So I think that absolutely has to be our first priority.
And so why isn't that happening, Doctor?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons. I think we heard Dr. Lipkin say that attention has been slow in coming to this problem. I think in many cases the infrastructures in these countries to both deliver needed materials and then utilize them in a medical care setting is really lacking. And this points to the fact that of something we frequently see in these disaster situations, which is that the international community responds to a disaster, comes in, you know, it's a wonderful humanitarian response. Look at these doctors and health workers, both in those countries and from around the world, who are trying to help. But then when it's done, those countries working with their partners really need to create a situation where there's a more permanent infrastructure that can prevent these situations from getting out of hand in the future. And that's what's really missing in countries with, I think, in typical incomes of several hundred dollars a year.
Let's play some sound here. This is Doctors Without Borders President Joanne Liu giving a press conference on Friday in Geneva to discuss the Ebola situation. She criticized the response from the World Health Organization.
WHO needs to take a leadership and bring some strong element into the field that are operational. And this needs to happen. It's already at startup, but needs to happen at all level, at coordination central level, at decentralization coordination level.
Dr. Lipkin, was the WHO slow off the mark on this, and has that impacted drug distribution?
Oh, I think it's very difficult to point fingers at this time. The WHO has been underfunded for years, and there was an initial blush of enthusiasm for support in emerging infectious diseases research after 9/11. There were centers funded around the world to do the kind of work that we need to do now. But I, for example, have had groups that have been trying to work in Sierra Leone and bring in advanced diagnostics. And one of the challenges we had there was that we didn't have consistent electrical power. You know, I think, you know, Jesse made the point about infrastructure, and this is key. You have to provide consistent power and clean water as well as personal protective equipment. It's a very low-tech approach that we need at present. Now, the WHO could do more if it had more resources. But remember, they have to be invited in by the countries, you know, where the problem occurs. They can't simply go in like a police force. So unless they're invited in and they're asked to make some sort of, you know, provide some sort of help, they can't go in. I think that we could have done far more in the developed world to provide these resources early in the course of the outbreak. And we should have done so. And my hope, of course, and I think, you know, Dr. Goodman mentioned this just a moment ago, is that rather than being reactive, we should become proactive, because this is not the first and it's not going to be the last such outbreak. And if the next one is an airborne virus or an airborne or something similar, you know, we could be in a much different situation. We could, in fact, be at risk for some sort of a global pandemic. The challenge here is local, it's regional, it's horrific, and we need to do much, much more. But I would start with low tech.
Let's get a caller in on this point. Poor Lee is from Boston. Hi, Poor Lee. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Poor Lee Kura here.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, so this region is a post-conflict region that has been affected by war over many years that has destroyed lives, and the infrastructure, as people have said, does not exist at this time.
Mm-hmm.
But with over 1,000 people dead, over 2,000 people affected, I think now is the time to move. I will recommend that the President of the United States deploy a military ship in the region with supplies to go and dock at the harbor in port in Monrovia and in Guinea,
mm-hmm.
to bring
uh-huh.
the supplies that these people need.
Poorly, I hear you. Let me turn that point. I appreciate your call to Dr. Goodman. Should the U.S. be doing more in this case, Doctor?
Well, I do know that the U.S. is actively exploring what kinds of medical assistance it can help provide. It's a difficult situation where one country, you know, unless requested, can't just unilaterally bring resources to bear. You know, there's issues of trust. There's issues of respect for national autonomy. I think in general, most countries in these global health emergencies work through the coordination of WHO. And I do know that the U.S. government is offering considerable potential resources to WHO. So while I agree that doing whatever we can to up the quality of care that can be provided there, including with U.S. resources, is a good idea, I do think we have to realize that we're operating in a global context and we have to be sensitive to the needs of these countries. The other issue is, even though our country is obviously so much better off, we have also seen budgets of money that would be used to pay for that kind of an operation shrink here in recent years. So the Department of Health and Human Services, CDC, and others who have helped so much in so many international outbreaks are also facing their own constraints.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation. From Monrovia, Liberia, is Dr. Anne Atai Omorutu. She is a doctor with the World Health Organization treating Ebola in Liberia. She's working with Ebola patients at JFK Hospital in Monrovia, part of a group of Ugandan specialists that have experience on Ebola. Dr. Anne, welcome to On Point. It's nice to have you.
Thank you.
I recognize we have a short delay on this line, but help us understand the impact of this outbreak where you are. We hear stories of no supplies, no aspirin, no IVs, not enough beds for patients. How dire is the situation in the treatment centers where you've been?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. The situation is actually quite dire. The main problem is the shortage of technical personnel that can actually give clinical care to the patients. There are just three isolation units in Liberia for Ebola. There is one at JFK, that's where I'm placed. There is another one also in Monrovia, and a third one up north. In Lofa. So these three isolation units are not adequate, and there aren't enough trained and skilled and experienced personnel helping out with the patient. So even when the patients actually come to the isolation unit, we don't have enough space for them. We don't have enough clinicians to take care of them.
So I understand that at least 170 health workers have contracted Ebola while treating patients, possibly more. That's according to the World Health Organization. How do you protect yourself, Dr. Omorutu? How do you protect yourself in the midst of all this?
Well, first of all, the health workers that have passed away due to Ebola, most of them contracted Ebola without realizing that Ebola was in the country. They didn't have the protective gear, and many of them got infected from fellow health workers who fell sick from patients. Yeah, it became a chain reaction. So how we protect ourselves is we do have PPE, so personal protective equipment, all of which has to be imported from various countries that produce them. Of course, the whole country has not been covered with the PPEs. Even if they were given all the PPEs, they have not had enough training on how to use, especially undoning, removing the PPEs, because that's the stage at which people get infected when you're removing the PPE.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to have the PPEs, another thing to know how to use
them. Right.
So,
we're running short on time, Doctor. Let me get another call in here from Waterbury, Connecticut. Gina is on the line. Gina, I'm glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
I had just a quick question. Earlier at the beginning of the program, you said some people had an ethical issue about using medication that was not approved yet. And I was just wondering if they know that there's something going to work, why, you know, and it's been tested on other people and it has worked, why can't we use it among the people in the country that, you know, I mean, why would there even be an issue if they know there's a medication back to work just because it wasn't FDA approved or whatever.
Got it, Gina. Thank you for calling. Dr. Jesse Goodman, would you respond?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. The real problem we're in right now is we don't know if any of these experimental medicines work. The stage they are at is they've been shown to work in a test tube. In some of the cases, they've been shown to work in non-human primates, which are the best model for Ebola virus infection. But they haven't been tested in humans. In many cases, there have not even been, and this was the case with the ZMAP that Dr. Brantley and Ms. Whitebull received, there weren't even human safety studies to see if this was safe first. So essentially, we don't know. But this is an opportunity to find out, which is very important to patients. You won't find out by distributing the medicine willy-nilly and seeing if there's some effect. But there can be the potential for trials of these medicines to determine if they work. Another point I'd like to make is we don't even know if modern medical care, like just good intravenous hydration, good care that we all take for granted in our hospitals and healthcare facilities, could greatly reduce the death toll from Ebola. We do know that, for example, with Marburg virus, a related virus, in one outbreak, in 1 year, the mortality was in the 70% in African countries, but in the 20% in Europe. So another very important question to answer and to help these people, if we can get the care to them, is whether improvements in routine medical care can also help. But I agree, and I think it's very important to fast track the most promising medicines. The other issue is their supplies. Right now, it's going to take several months to have enough supplies to even be able to do clinical studies, let alone use them in some widespread manner. But excellent question.
Dr. Lipkin, let me turn to you. Dr. Goodman just brought up those American aid workers infected with Ebola who were brought back to Atlanta, to Emory University. Dr. Kent Brantley and Nancy Whitebull, how are they doing? What is their prognosis?
They're improving. And one of the challenges we have right now is that people keep talking about the secret serum, the mystery serum, as though we are, in fact, withholding from Africans access to these materials, which I think, as Dr. Goodman has just pointed out, we don't even know that they're effective as yet. Many of these drugs have been tested in rats and mice, and that's not a good predictor of whether or not they're going to be effective in humans. And even sometimes we have differences between non-human primates and people. So it's very important. The first principle is first do no harm. We have to make certain that these drugs are safe. Now, given the number of people who are at risk and the potential, you know, for these medications to be effective, we should fast track them. We should find ways in which we can identify ways in which we can do trials in a safe and fair way to find out whether or not they are effective. And if they are, then we should make them available and produce them with all haste.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're discussing the Ebola outbreak. For months, it has been spreading in West Africa. Fears are growing now that it will hit many of Africa's largest cities. Here's a Nigerian man who talked to the BBC on Friday about how his life has changed since the Ebola outbreak.
I am a pharmacist, and previously I didn't used to work with gloves and use sanitizers very frequently, but in recent times I've had to do that because obviously I need to protect myself. I come in contact with all kinds of people every day.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Anne Omorutu. She's a doctor with the World Health Organization treating Ebola in Liberia. Also, Dr. Ian Lipkin. He's an expert in viral diseases and director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University. He has over 30 years of experience with outbreak response, including AIDS, West Nile virus, and SARS, and with Jesse Goodman, director of Georgetown University's Compass Center, a health policy research center. I want to go back to the phones. Wea is calling from North Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to the program. Glad you waited. You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to ask a question. Why is it the ministry, the health ministry in Liberia haven't yet involved the community. I mean, in Africa, I'm from Liberia. I have all my family over there, and this thing is bothering me. I work with the government. In Africa, we literally have a traditional system, and that doesn't mean Africans are not educated. That's what many people think. They just are not knowledgeable of Western traditions or Western system of life. They have their own system of life. If you try to help them by excluding them, you are not actually helping them. The United Nations have a very large presence of forces over there, including the police. So I don't understand why having the government get a clear definition of its role, a clear definition of the health workers that are coming from foreign land, and create a role for the community.
Got it. Let me turn that question to Dr. Ann Atai Omorutu. How involved are local communities in the treatment, Dr. Ann? Are they being excluded to some extent? And if they were not, would that help?
I'm not sure I'm very competent to comment on that, except that I think some of the issues, the practices, the burial practices that some of us in Africa perform, we touch the body, we bathe them, we brush their teeth, we comb their hair so that they go well. So it's become very difficult to convince the community that they should stop that because it is help, it is promoting the spread of Ebola. So the very Africanness of the nature of burial is actually a barrier, and it takes time to convince people. Meanwhile, Ebola is on rampage. So that is the problem. The rate at which the virus moves and the rate at which we are able to change our behavior is a problem.
Ebola on the rampage. I hear you, Dr. Ann. Thank you. Robert, let's get you in here from Lincoln, Nebraska. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I just a couple of questions is how much genetic variation has been seen in the Ebola virus? And then what is a reservoir species for Ebola? Just an observation is that there's a type of mushroom poisoning called the death angel where there's a progressive organ failure similar to the disease, but the fatality rate from it went from around 80 or 90% to 10%, but it required really aggressive intervention on the part of hospital and support, but that's just an observation. But anyway, the first two questions, I just was curious how much genetic variation has been seen in the virus.
Robert, thank you very much. Dr. Ian Lipkin, I'll let you answer that.
Well, let me take the first one, which has the first one discussing the amount of genetic variation. This looks very much like previous Ebola viruses. There are some slight differences, but nothing that would indicate that it's going to change in terms of its ability to cause disease or its ability to transmit. The second question had to do with the reservoir, and for many of your listeners, they may not know what that means. I think what our caller is referring to is there an animal in which this virus is present frequently without causing disease for long periods of time and then periodically jumps from that particular animal into humans directly or through some intermediate host. Now, we presume, based on analogy to Marburg virus, which is a very similar virus, that the reservoir for this virus is going to be a bat, but we don't know that for certain. We do know that apes and primates in general can be intermediate hosts, and this is one way in which people can become initially infected as a result of collecting bushmeat for protein during the process of hunting that animal or butchering that animal. They get exposed to blood from that infected animal. It may be easier to bring down that animal because it's ill, and then at that point it gets into the human population.
I've got to say goodbye to Dr. Ann Omorutu, but I want to ask you before you leave, Doctor, what would you tell us halfway around the world about the Ebola outbreak where you are and your efforts to treat it? What do you want people to know here?
Well, I just want the world to know that the Liberians are suffering. The Liberians need technical help, and they need people to come here and help. This needs like a one-on-one interaction between the contacts and people who are able to give them a message that Ebola must stop and you must participate in stopping Ebola. So we need people who can package messages, people who know how to engage communities, and you know, and then we need the technical expertise so that when the sick are identified, they get the optimum care that they can.
Before it spreads even further. Dr. Anne Omorutu, thank you so much for your time, doctor. She's in Liberia with the World Health Organization working to stave off the spread of Ebola. Thank you so much, doctor. Appreciate your time and good luck to you. Let's go back to the phones now. Abdul is calling from Wasuko, Wisconsin. Nice to have you, Abdul. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I am a Sierra Leonean living in Waukesha, Wisconsin. And I talk to my people every day, and we are disturbed by the WHO and the Western world leaders who continue to fill the world in giving direct support to the affected countries. Mm-hmm. The whole world knows that corruption and failed leadership is the order of the day in these countries. Response to this kind of crisis should be direct with adequate representatives on the ground, like MSF, Doctors Without Borders, but yet they continue to outcry WHO for lack of support. This outbreak is in its fifth month, and yet we continue to hear excuses, inadequate support, and traditional attitude of local people. But yet there are reports of survivors. So meaning is just because people are dying because they are not getting the adequate support.
Abdul, thank you very much. I hear what you're saying. Dr. Lipkin, is this mostly now in the hands of international nonprofit groups? Are they at the front line of this outbreak right now, would you say?
I think at this point it really is incumbent upon the developed world to respond. I know the Centers for Disease Control, the United States Department of Defense, and many others are involved in trying to provide diagnostic care and training in West Africa at the sites where it's most needed. In addition, of course, you have Medicine Frontier, which has been on the front lines and will continue to be on the front lines, and they need our support as well. But there isn't the kind of training, as you've heard earlier, in country to do this on their own. They don't have the equipment. They don't have the training. So it's a bleak situation unless we provide those resources.
Dr. Lipkin, you spent some time in quarantine yourself back in 2003 after working to contain the SARS outbreak. Will you tell us what that was like?
It's eerie. You don't have contact with loved ones or with friends. But in a place like New York, I'm able to access internet, and I was able to continue to run my laboratory and do everything that I needed to do. I did not have SARS. I had a very bad form of influenza, but it's tough. And if you are sick, and if you're very sick, and it's difficult to get people to take care of you, even to provide such basic needs as hydration, you can actually simply die from dehydration. I think this was the point that Dr. Goodwin was making earlier, and that is that many people are simply suffering and some are dying, not necessarily just because of Ebola, but because they have other disorders where they're not being treated.
Right. Dr. Goodman, put Ebola into perspective for us with other past epidemics like SARS, like bird flu, like H1N1. How does Ebola compare in potential seriousness?
Well, I think, that's kind of like a relativistic question in comparing different evils. I think if you think of it in terms of global public health risks, one thing that makes Ebola a little less risky is that it isn't generally spread through the respiratory route. That hasn't occurred. So it does, as everybody has been saying, require contact. However, that doesn't detract from this being, a catastrophic humanitarian emergency with a lot of suffering. It also, I think we see, when we see very knowledgeable people like Dr. Brantley, Ms. Wrightball, get infected there, we do see that public health measures and infection control aren't perfect. We do know that with global transportation the way it is, even a disease that's not communicable by a respiratory route could potentially spread and infect people elsewhere. So I think both for the people there and the people in the world, we should be concerned about this both as an infectious disease and as a humanitarian emergency. The numbers are less, but when you hear these stories of the impact on communities, many of whom may not understand what's going on, families where 9 or 10 individuals, including children and grandparents, have all died from the disease. I don't think there's a way of overstating, you know, how awful that is.
Here's Carrie calling from Northbridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. I have a question regarding the transmissibility during the incubation period, which can be up to 21 days, where a person who's infected can be asymptomatic and maybe cough or sneeze or have some body fluid on their hands and touch the surface. How long can the virus live on surfaces, and how does that translate to stop the spread in West Africa and beyond its borders?
Carrie, thank you. Dr. Ian Lipkin?
Well, first of all, you've talked about the incubation period as being 2 to 21 days. Those are the figures that represent the outer bounds. Most people have an incubation period of 7 or 8 days, so it's really much shorter. And during the period when somebody is infected but asymptomatic, they are not contagious. And this is one of the reasons why we're less concerned about people sitting next to an individual who might be infected on a plane, for example. Now, the virus can live up to hours on some surfaces and shorter periods of time on others. It really depends on what it's in. If it's in blood, then it may be relatively protected and more stable. If, on the other hand, it's on a smooth surface and it's exposed to sunlight, it's not going to be stable for much longer than a few minutes. So there is really no hard and fast rule. I think what we really need to ensure is that those people who are medical care workers, those who are providing support for medical care workers, have the appropriate PPE and the ways to decontaminate these areas so that they don't have that sort of risk. But in terms of your personal risk, if that's a concern, I don't think that that's a major concern.
Dr. Goodman, there doesn't sound like there is much concern about a potential or possible Ebola outbreak in the United States.
Well, I think that because of a high level of awareness, infectious disease surveillance in this country, and a relatively well-off medical infrastructure where, in general, healthcare facilities, emergency rooms that are dealing with people with an uncharacterized infectious disease, particularly if they've come from an area where there's a concern about an outbreak, are going to use good personal protective equipment or the PPE Dr. Lipkin mentioned, I think the concerns are much reduced here. I don't think we should be completely overconfident. I think individuals could get on a plane feeling relatively well, come here and become sick. They could potentially infect others before people realize what's going on. I think given the resources and infection control here, it's likely that would be contained relatively easily. Again, that doesn't mean there's not the potential for some infection or human suffering.
Dr. Lipkin, do you agree with that?
Well, I agree with it. I think probably in whole, but I'm not entirely clear that I do. So I just want to emphasize a few points. It is possible that someone could arrive here in the United States who was infected with Ebola. They could become symptomatic. They could probably infect one or two people, I would think, before the diagnosis is made and the appropriate containment measures are employed. But I do not envision anything like a large group of people, like 50 or 100 people, becoming infected and then being satellite areas of infection thereafter. It's just implausible. This is not, again, a respiratory transmission system. So you're not going to see that sort of, you know, easy spread.
Dr. Goodman.
I was going to add that, and Ian may want to add to this, but I know, I believe, of two instances where individuals came without the diagnosis to a Western healthcare system. One was in Switzerland. One was also in Africa, but in South Africa, which is relatively well-resourced medically. And I think in South Africa, the individual was rapidly isolated. It was recognized that there needed to be caution. I think one subsequent individual was infected there, but that was easily contained. In Switzerland, again, the person was isolated before the diagnosis was made, but because of suspicion, these are in previous outbreaks, and no propagation of infection. So those, it's a very small number, but that's somewhat reassuring. But, you know, I think we can never say never, and we need to have our guard up, which is what CDC is encouraging everyone to do.
A devastating disease. Thanks to our guests for helping us understand what's happening today. Dr. Ian Lipkin, expert in viral diseases, director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University. Dr. Lipkin, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Dr. Jesse Goodman, director of Georgetown's Compass Center. Dr. Goodman, thanks to you as well.
You're very welcome.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thank you for your calls. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.